The second thing, if you are interested in pursuing a PhD, I often get students asking me, what school should I apply to? Which program should I apply to? Do I need to apply to the best school with the biggest name? And my answer typically is that the most important thing about your PhD, the most important thing is your, at least in the experience of how much you would enjoy your PhD, is your relationship with your supervisor. So writing a PhD in most disciplines, especially in political science, is a pretty solitary business. So you're responsible for a project. You need to bring it to completion. You have someone who helps you where necessary, but the degree to which different supervisors help you is very different from one to another. I would say rather than trying to find where to go based on the name of the school or the name of the program, I would first and foremost think, what is it that I want to study? And who in the world, or if you want to say in Canada, who in Canada is kind of rock that I would like to work with? And then email them directly, contact them directly with your suggestions for a research project. See how they respond. Then you will already get a sense of whether or not that person is going to be the kind of supervisor who responds quickly for your email. It's going to be helpful over email. I did exactly this. I made a list of scholars in the world I wanted to work with. And I had a sort of a top three list that I started with. One of them didn't respond to my email. The second one sent me an email saying, Dear Edward, you can find the instructions for applying to our PhD program on this website. And the third actually said, Dear Edward, thanks for your kind email. I'm glad you find my research useful. It's always nice being read. I've taken a look at your proposal. Here are six suggestions about your research project. Here's some additional literature you might want to consult. But above all, though, I would urge you to apply. I think we offer a good environment for this research project. Don't hesitate to give me a call if you want to chat about anything more. So all of this to say is the response I got was very different, and I knew immediately this third supervisor would be someone who would be actually excited to work with me and also helpful in the process. So I think those would be my two pieces of advice is, first of all, make very sure you want to do it, and second, if you do, think about the research project you want and contact your intended supervisor before you even start applying, because that will tell you a lot about the kind of person that might be and the degree to which you will enjoy your PhD.
I think that's very valuable advice, because I remember when I was completing my graduate degree at the University of Waterloo, I completed my master's in public service, and throughout my graduate studies, I had an opportunity to talk to various students that were completing a PhD, and a lot of them said that, you know, completing a PhD is extremely demanding, and it's something that can take 8 years of your time out of your life. So it has to be something that you're, as you mentioned, passionate about pursuing. And I think that every student should contact, as you mentioned, supervisors or individuals that they're interested in perhaps working with. So conducting that research, looking at options, and then seeing who to contact would be a good strategy as to pursuing that path. The process of completing a PhD is very demanding. It can be rewarding if it's something that you're 100% certain that you want to pursue, then it's definitely worth investing in. But if it's something that you are considering but you're not 100% certain, then I think it's useful talking to individuals who have successfully completed a PhD as to what their studies were like, how they found the experience to be, and then any useful advice that they can provide. But again, talking to potential supervisors that one would want to work with would definitely be the best way to go. And now, Dr. Koning, I want to mention that on Wednesday, August the 17th, two of my colleagues, Leila Wahbi and Idil Alsin Kaya, successfully organized an event on mass migration and border control, a divide in the European Union. As one of the panelists, can you tell our audience more about the significance and the impact of the discussion that took place on the 17th of August at University of Toronto's Hart House.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was a very good panel discussion we had. And as I was mentioning there, I think it is of tremendous importance that we keep on discussing this Mediterranean refugee crisis, even though in recent years the numbers of people applying for asylum in Europe has decreased. So I don't know, did I say in recent years? What I meant is over the last year. So there was this very big spike of refugee applicants in the third quarter of 2015. Very, very large number, almost more than a million refugees who of people who applied for asylum status somewhere on in the European Union within the scope of 3 months. Those kinds of flows do not exist anymore. So both in academic context, but also in the media in general, I'm noticing that the amount of attention for the crisis is has waned a little bit, and for that reason, I thought it was really good that that Leila and Adil organized this panel. I mean, the thing that we cannot forget is that that for one thing, it is truly a crisis. It's been said many times, but it's worth repeating to impress upon you how big of a crisis it is that half of the population of Syria, as a result of the civil war, is being displaced or murdered. These are numbers that are unfathomable. We still have, even though we don't have that many new applicants, we still have large number of people who are on the run, who live in uncertainty, who live in terrible conditions, who don't know whether their asylum claim will be accepted. On top of that, we have a political climate where there doesn't seem to be all that much political willingness to see eye to eye with each other and to find constructive solutions for these issues. So that's the primary reason why I think it's important that we have these kinds of discussions. Second, I would also say that an additional reason why we might want to look at it is that even though this refugee crisis is relatively new in terms of its sheer size, of course, this feeds into all kinds of developments that have already been lingering in Europe for 20, 30 years in relation to immigration and multiculturalism and how that plays out in European democracy. So, as most of your listeners, I'm sure, will know, is that in Europe, on average, people tend to think less favorably about immigrants than Canadians do, and relatedly, immigrants in Europe tend to think less favorably about their host society than immigrants in Canada do. So you already have those lingering tensions between migrants and native born that have been exacerbated by this crisis, and a related development that is interesting taking into account that the frame to look at the crisis is the difficulties of European integration. So,
And now, in your opinion, do you think that EU member states can respond effectively as a cohesive entity as time progresses?
So I'm very skeptical about that. Mm-hmm. The reasons are, I guess, mostly twofold, and it basically continues what I was just about to say. One is that, to pick up on the point that I was ending with just now, is that the history of European integration is a long one, and it is one that is being marked by controversy about the ceding of national sovereignty to the supranational government of the European Union. So you basically have a whole bunch of nation states that at some point decided to work together economically. But as they started to work together economically, they also started to work together more closely on judicial matters and on political matters. And what we end up right now is some sort of weird entity that's difficult to describe, that's called the European Union, We have, well, now 28 member states, but so we know that the UK wants to leave, and it's a bit unclear what happens. That have a very complex set of responsibilities over domestic policy. So some areas are in the exclusive responsibility of the member states themselves. Others are navigated by the supranational level, either the European Commission or the European Council. And so when we talk about immigration in particular, so considering that the European Union wants to pursue a common market, the borders within Europe to move from one country to another are all sort of regulated by European laws. It's possible to organize markets without doing that. But when it comes to borders outside of Europe, so people from outside of Europe going into a European Union member state, European member states have been much more reluctant to cede responsibility, to give up the responsibility, to give up the national sovereignty over those issues and let the European Union regulate this. Now, there are certainly some areas EU admission policies that I'd be happy to comment on more if you want to, like the common European asylum system. And now there's much talk about that proposed deal with Turkey. But by and large, we cannot really talk about a European admission policy the same way we could talk about, let's say, an American admission policy, or even a Canadian admission policy, even though they're also Quebec has some responsibility over the admission study. And at this point, I've only been talking about admission policy, so policies that determine under which conditions someone can enter the country. When we talk about integration policy, so the kinds of rights that immigrants enjoy when they are in a country, or naturalization policy, so the kinds of conditions under which someone can acquire citizenship, those issues are almost entirely in the hands of member states still. So the first answer to your question about can Europe find a unified solution, and so the first component of my answer being no, is that there is a lot of division of responsibility between member states and the European Union. Lots of member states are unwilling to give up their sovereignty over those issues. And on top of that, a lot of member states don't see eye to eye with each other. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, of course, as I alluded to, is that there are lots of politicians in Europe that want to take advantage of the lingering tension between immigrants and native born. So you have a large number of apparently anti-immigrant politicians that have a prominent position in European politics. So in some countries, probably most notably in Hungary, you have a government that is actually run by one of those politicians. But in a lot of other countries, you see those kinds of parties being the second or third or fourth, or in the case of Switzerland, the first biggest party in parliament. And so these parties, they are keen on derailing any issue, any attempt at finding constructive solutions, because they are, first of all, almost all of them are anti-European integration. So whenever Europe does something well, that's bad publicity for them. And second, they are also very much catering to fear about immigration. So whenever things go poorly with immigrant integration, that also means more support for them. So these parties cannot be seen as offering any constructive contribution to these issues. And in fact, I mostly see them as one of the most important hurdles to coherent policy approach, along with the issues surrounding sovereignty that I just described.